issues about the space and the time and how we can come up with definitions and criteria to determine what the space-time background of the multiverse should be and some sort of hierarchy. Gene, you notice there is a question mark there. I have no answers, I only questions. But one important and exciting development, I think, recently, is this conceptual shift in our way of thinking. Until now, much of our thinking and work has been done along the lines of symmetry breaking. And now, recently, for the first time, we are seriously contemplating that a new direction to solve some of the deepest mysteries might be the extension of our physical theories to the multiverse, which we can think of as an extension of the Copernican principle. Can you hear me? So until now, the Earth was not at the center of the universe, and now the universe is not at the center of the multiverse. And then there are good reasons that I will go through in the next slide to believe that the existence of the multiverse might not be just a philosophical contemplation, but might be a real thing. And as such, then we have to take it seriously. So it is quite curious why recently, and I think string theory has contributed quite a lot on driving this radical switch in our way of thinking, but it is curious why recently, instead of thinking of mechanisms of symmetry breaking, we are thinking of extending our physics to a higher level, to that of the multiverse, in order to address fundamental mysteries of nature. So why this sudden change of heart? And I believe it's by necessity, and I will try to make a case in terms of the question of the initial conditions for our universe, and also by experience. We should get a hint from our current theories that perhaps the multiverse extension is not to go away, but it might be a generic prediction of any candidate of quantum gravity. So let me first go to the necessary part. Why I think that we'll see a lot more of the multiverse talk than we have seen in the past. Well, we still face this old and extremely important mystery of the initial conditions of our universe. And I do not see any other way to address this question, why did we start with such initial conditions, without implying as compared to what other choices. So I cannot see how we can address the issue of the initial conditions of the universe without appealing to a multiverse framework from the very start, and not to mention the long list of why this particular choice of the constants of nature, like and dark energy and things like that. So I think that, yeah.
So indeed, if you enlarge the domain to include all these other possibilities, then there's a real question why these initial conditions rather than others, like you're saying. But wouldn't the more conservative, at least with this motivation, simply be to simply say that it's a non-question why these initial conditions, that's what it was, and be done with it. In other words, by enlarging it, you're creating a problem, you're creating a question, as opposed to solving a question.
I absolutely agree, but as physicists, we usually are not happy with saying this is simply the way it is. We'd like to have a deeper understanding of why it is in that manner.
Only when there really is an option for the other possibility.
Absolutely.
Just to query this, I mean, the space of initial conditions is just the configuration space of whatever theory it is that describes the cosmology.
Sure.
So that is nothing new. In Newtonian cosmology, there is a space of initial conditions. And in general relativity, there's a space of initial conditions. And in both cases, they're equivalent to the space of solutions. What's new is making what we thought of were parameters in the laws of physics, like coupling constants, part of the configuration space and therefore part of the space.
Yes, I agree. And in fact, that's in a couple of slides, you'll see that that's the case I'm making, that in fact, this idea of a phase space or a multiverse has been around for quite a long time. And yet, even now, the majority would still keep away from talking about that subject. So it's probably time that we take it seriously, and there might be a good reason why.
But is what you're saying, it's always been the case that there was a phase space or a configuration space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been the case that, as applied to cosmology, that only one solution was realized and the rest were not realized. I mean, nothing's changed unless you're bringing into question the idea of why shouldn't every solution be, you know, why should the solutions which are not realized be on a different status than the one which is realized?
Yes. So until now, at least that's my understanding, there was no well-defined way of picking that particular solution. That's the big mystery of the initial conditions, why we have this particular solution. But that's pretty much been the line of thinking. You start from a phase space, and then one is picked. I would not like to cut that by hand, to cut the field of choice by hand, without having some underlying dynamics criteria, and finding out whether we end up with only one solution or more. So the phase space part has always been around. I will try to promote them into a quantum phase of a multiverse. But in trying to answer the issue of the initial conditions, we will end up with more than one choice.
But what's confusing to me about this is what initial conditions were designed to do. The whole point was that somebody proposed the law of nature. Mm-hmm. And it applied not just, Newtonian dynamics, it applied not to one case, it applied to an infinite number of cases. And the distinction between the single law governing an infinite number of cases, that was made possible by having a space of solutions which was infinite dimensional, and therefore having a space of initial conditions. So the distinction between law and initial conditions is not a problem, it's the thing that made physics possible.
Maybe I'm not understanding
if we had
your question, but I thought that the problem of the initial conditions of that, picking just that one that happened to be our universe, that still remains a problem. Is that not correct?
No, I'm saying that the methodology of having dynamical laws which have free initial conditions mm-hmm. is what made physics succeed.
Absolutely.
The mystery is if we think that that same methodology should apply to cosmology. Because that means that the infinite number of different conditions mm-hmm. is necessary in order to have an application of, say, Newton's dynamics or
okay.
QED or QCD or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. What's novel is the conundrum we get into when we take the same methodology and apply it to cosmology.
True.
On the basis that there's just one universe?
Yes.
Okay, so, I think you're asking me whether I should take a fundamental approach to selecting the initial conditions from the start without applying the conundrum of our well-known physics theories, or whether I should investigate the problem in some different way, say, by a dynamical approach,
yes.
and starting with the most generic pool of options there is, and finding out how many of those eventually grow to universes.
Mm. This is a discussion conference, but maybe we're taking too much advantage.
Okay. So another point I could think of that helps to make the case in the sense of the multiverse existence is that the black box model we have been using for quite a long time now, as we have seen from talks in the morning, has created huge discrepancies with what we observe in the universe. All this talk about Boltzmann breaks and the troubles with the era of time demanding a very low entropy in the past, which seems to make the universe extremely unlikely, the high energy inflationary universe very unlikely. All of those troubles perhaps are giving us hints that we need to change our way of thinking and studying the problems of the initial conditions and probably even of dark energy. So, we already know that inflation already predicts a universe much larger than the observable domain, and yet there is no good reason why stop there. At the end of the day, that Big Bang that eventually gave rise to our universe was only a local event in the neighborhood of our initial conditions in the phase space. And there is no indication I can think of that this local theory is cohesive and doesn't need to be embedded in a much higher theory. As marvelous as the inflationary paradigm is and all the problems it addresses in cosmology, it still comes with the price tag of making the problem, the puzzle of the initial conditions, much worse. Basically, standard estimates show that the chances to start with high energy inflation are one part in 10^10^122. Here is this number again that Paul was talking about in the morning. And then there are other issues, such as what bank and where did that come from? So the puzzle of the initial conditions in the phase space picture boils down to the fact that if this blue rectangle is the phase space of all possible initial conditions that I'll think of as the quantum phase of the multiverse, then why do our initial conditions occupy such an extremely small volume in that phase space? Well, two are the obvious possibilities. One is that our initial conditions are extremely special. That's why they are handpicked, and that's why they occupy such a small volume. But there is another choice, and that's based on dynamics. We know that as a system reaches equilibrium and goes towards equilibrium, it maximizes the volume in phase space, which means that being far away from equilibrium, you occupy a much smaller volume in phase space. So having a small volume in phase space, which means a small entropy for the early universe, might not mean that it was handpicked and extremely special. It might simply mean that it was far out of equilibrium. So there are certain things that I believe it's time to think more thoroughly and carefully about. Another issue is the role of gravitational degrees of freedom. Those are not included in the simple estimate of the chance to start with high energy inflation. But as we know, gravity plays an extremely important role, especially when thinking about how a system where gravitational degrees of freedom are concerned reaches equilibrium. If we don't care about gravity, we have a room filled with gas, which is arranged in a very special state, all collected at the corner of the room. We let go, it will reach equilibrium by filling the whole room. If we care about gravity, then we know that waiting long enough, eventually, it will collapse into a black hole. So the two stories are very different, and that is what I'm trying to advocate. I have no answer about the multiverse, and there are so many already, probably a lot more to come. But one thing is for sure, that we are at that stage in physics where this topic needs to be addressed carefully because of these paradoxes and troubles we run to in foundational physics. This is the other illustration that I'll go over very briefly because Paul and Jim talked about it, the Boltzmann brains paradox, which is a different way of saying the same things. If the initial conditions of our universe, the birth of our universe, is such an extremely special event with such extremely low probability, anything else, absolutely anything you can think of to nucleate has got a much higher probability and should eventually overwhelm us because we are part of a nonlinear fluctuation that took 5 billion years to create and it was a function of giving birth to the universe first. So anything else that comes under the name Boltzmann brains has got a much higher probability to be around. Then how come we don't see those events? There are all these discrepancies that perhaps they are indicating a crack in our understanding in the foundations of physics. Now, when it comes to entropy and probability calculations, we can turn this problem around and think in terms of information. Because at the end of the day, entropy parameterizes the information contained in the system. But we all know that information is contained in correlation. And we are all at ease in calculating correlations. Then how come we run into trouble when talking about entropy? We can't confidently say that we understand what the entropy of the universe is, and yet we can calculate the correlations exactly. And I think the reason is because it boils down to the issue, which correlations do we include? Do we cut off by hand at the horizon and include only those proportional to the surface area enveloping our universe? Do, if there is such a thing as non-local entanglement, do we include those correlations? Well, one gets very different answers when including different types of correlations. But I find that an easier way of thinking about the entropy problem and the probability than the disorder measure. So that's the part where I think it might become necessary that we do extend our theories to a multiverse framework. And yet this is not new. Three of our major theories have already come up with the multiverse for over 50 years now. Quantum mechanics, Jim talked about the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. That's a multiverse prediction. The inflationary paradigm, almost all inflationary models generically predict that they produce eternal inflation. So eternal inflation is an inflationary multiverse. You continually produce bubbles because quantum mechanically there's always some domain around that can end up with this large fluctuation that can give rise to that little domain, give rise to a inflation again. So you produce a new bubble and that occurs eternally. So that's a multiverse prediction. And then most recently, string theory also predicted a multiverse. The landscape of string theory, in fact, as I'll argue further, is nothing more than a multiverse prediction of this theory. Now, on the bright side, having three major theories predict a multiverse, whether we like it or not, it might be a good hint that we need the multiverse. And it might be a good hint that any candidate of quantum gravity in the future must have the multiverse prediction as part of its conclusions. On the dim side, if there is only one physical reality, I don't know what physical reality is. In fact, my parents and my husband say I'm the only person in the family that knows nothing about reality. But whatever that physical reality is, I think we all share the common sense that there is only one physical reality, and somehow there is a background space-time associated with that physical reality. So if there is only one, we can't have three different multiverses already correspond to only one physical reality. So we are coming to the problem of how do we select which multiverse is the one that corresponds to physical reality. And at some level, this is becoming dangerous because even if a multiverse picture helps with addressing the puzzle of the initial conditions, it seems like we are shifting the same problem from finding out why these initial conditions to trying and find out which multiverse. Hello?
But you have a many worlds interpretation, so you have multiverse in the sense of lots of quasi-classical worlds in quantum superposition with one another, but then also it turns out to be the case that within each of those things that are in superposition with one another, you have an infinite space, lots of planets dotting around the place, so you've got multiverse in that sense as well. I mean, if you had that sort of scenario, then you'd have two senses in which we have a multiverse, not identical to one another, but both true. Why can't that happen?
Well, I knew I was having trouble with philosophers, but
you
haven't defined your physical reality.
Again?
You haven't defined what you mean by physical reality.
I mean,
or what the multiverse is. Are there two multiverses in that example?
There's two senses in which reality has a multiverse nature.
But you have only one reality,
right,
even in that picture.
Right, but there's a quantum superposition sense of multiverse. And there's a spatial separation in terms of multiverse. And they're not the same, but they're both true. I mean, more than one thing is true, that's another thing.
And we know how to switch from one picture to another. You're still talking about the same multiverse, but in a quantum description and the space-time classical description. So I don't see a problem there.
Well, the problem is that you said they can't all correspond to reality unless they're identical. And I was trying to paint a scenario in which they both corresponded to reality, but they're
not
identical.
Okay, I understand. No. For all three multiverses you see there, I'm assuming that all of them have a quantum and the classical description. So the question is not distinguishing between the quantum or the classical being part of reality, but assuming that you can have a one-to-one correspondence on the quantum phase for all three of them, or on the classical phase for all three of them, then which one is it? If you stick to the space separation multiverse, suppose two different theories give you two different types of space-separated multiverse, would you agree that you can have only one corresponding to physical reality? Okay. So that's what I mean. Sticking within a phase, then only one of them can be.
Max Tegmark has argued that the first two are in fact equivalent because when you have eternal inflation, you generate every branch of the wave function in some sort of quantum cosmology model, so they become instantiated in the cosmological multiverse. And you don't get any more than you would from level one. But these levels are identical. So it's probably model dependent.
I'm confused about what argument you're making. I mean, there are, in each of these three, there are alternatives. So let's take the first two. And there are versions of the interpretation of quantum mechanics which are not many worlds, for example, Bohmian. Mm-hmm. And there are versions of cosmology, for example, ekpyrotic, which don't have inflation as the explanation for the scale and grain fluctuation, therefore don't have eternal inflation. Therefore, they're logically independent. Well, it may be that the many worlds interpretation turns out to be the better interpretation of quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. but inflation turns out to be wrong, and we'll know that because there are no tensor modes of the required amplitude and so forth. You're not claiming that they're logically.
No, I'm not claiming that all the theories we have must predict the multiverse. I'm just giving three examples of three theories that the majority of the community would give a confidence vote on. And suddenly, even these theories, I think when they started, it's fair to say that we didn't expect they would end up predicting the multiverse. So I'm just giving three examples where, even though we didn't start with that motivation in mind, it still led us along the multiverse.
It's also possible that there's a profound mistake that we're making over and over again.
Absolutely.
In these settings.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why the talk is more about provoking a discussion on these fundamental issues rather than giving the bottom line on each. I don't think any of us knows what the bottom line is, but it's worth talking about.
Do you think, I mean, Roger Penrose says sometimes at this juncture that it's much better to have one rigorous, convincing argument for a conclusion than three hand-waving ones. Do you think any of the three of these are sort of irrefutably strong?
I don't believe the average interpretation of quantum mechanics. It's pretty well motivated and thoroughly worked out. I also think inflation has been given to that in terms of details. I'm not quite sure about the internal nature, but it could be true. And for the string theory landscape, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's hardcore precise mathematics when it comes to obtaining the landscape solutions. Which again, what was considered a crisis wasn't even expected.
But because people have studied that, you know, millions of inflationary models doesn't make it the actual field.
Say that again.
The fact that it's been beaten to death, as you say, doesn't make it right.
Oh, absolutely not. None. If we knew what's right and wrong, it would be a fantastic leap forward. Problem is, we have no idea. We are in unknown territory. We don't even know what space time. We haven't asked a simple question, what space time the multiverse is. But yeah, so that's the whole point. Then let's discuss the things that we feel more confident about and the ones we don't. No, I'm not advocating that, and I didn't bet my life that inflation is the final truth in nature, but I think it's pretty thoroughly investigated. I think that's a fair statement. But Lev can speak for inflation.
Be speechless.
Okay, so back to inflation. The fact that the eternal nature of inflation seems to be generic, I take that as an indicator. Not as a rigorous statement, but as an indicator that, again, why should a multiverse prediction end up in a theory which is not related to the other two I mentioned before? And now comes string theory landscape. From around 2002 onwards, with pioneering work from Gustav Ochinski, Banks, Douglas, Deneuve, Susskind, instead of finding that the hope was to find one solution. And people didn't find one solution. They found a whole array, a whole landscape of solutions of three plus one-dimensional worlds with universes just like ours. And that was pretty much a surprise. The big question was, what selected our universe in this multitude, in this vastness of the landscape? And that was considered such a disaster result that it was almost promoted to a crisis for string theory. However, I think that that was a great indicator that any contender for quantum gravity should end up with a multiverse prediction. Otherwise, how could we address these fundamental issues that we expect to address from quantum gravity? But there is a sociological reason on why finding more than one solution, finding a whole landscape of solutions, was considered a bad thing to find. Because I think until now, the majority of us had embraced this reductionist view, where we were hoping that whatever that ultimate theory was, it would yield us just one unique solution with a universe that looked like ours. And we didn't end up with one unique solution, we ended up with many of them, probably an infinite number of them. So I'd like to advocate a meritocratic point of view instead of the reductionist point of view. Perhaps we should not end up with one unique solution. Maybe that's the way to go in addressing this kind of fundamental issues like the initial conditions of the universe. Perhaps we do need that whole landscape, that whole multiverse, to even meaningfully ask the question what selected our universe out of the whole landscape. When this is work done on the last 3 or 4 years, but when this method is applied to the string theory landscape, the way to do a real calculation through this example is to allow the wave function of the universe propagate on the landscape background and follow pretty much the recipe that Jim Hartle was describing before. Of course, the coherence has to be a very strong ingredient of the approach. In our case, we consider the super horizon wavelength massive modes to be the path that induces the coherence on our domain. And it's an n-body problem. You have many, many universes, many initial patches, just like ours. Then what happens at the end is that from all the possible initial conditions in that landscape of string theory, only a subset of those can give rise to relevant physically big universes. Because following the dynamics, and especially addressing worrying about issues like the coherence and quantum to classical transition, what happens is that all the gravitational degrees of freedom, by which I mean the ones contained in the initial vacuum energy of that patch, are trying to reach equilibrium by making the initial patch expand to infinity. That's what lambda does. It makes a universe blow up. But then you also have all these massive modes that are trying to reach equilibrium by pulling that initial patch to a point. So the fight between the two, which is a tug of war, determines whether that initial patch will grow and become physically relevant or will disappear to a point and from the phase space and be irrelevant to the classical collection of universes. So I coined the ones that survive the back reaction of matter, survivor universes, because these are the relevant ones. So although even following this recipe, you don't end up with one unique universe that looks like ours, you end up with a collection of them. So the multiverse remains, even after the quantum to classical description, still dynamics in this case prove to be very important. And this whole kind of progress was achieved only by changing the point of view from reductionist to meritocratic. Now, a nice byproduct of following this recipe is that it embeds the landscape of string theory into the quantum mechanics multiverse. I should emphasize this point, although I'm allowing the wave function of the universe to propagate on the landscape in this particular example. I am not doing quantum cosmology, I'm doing quantum mechanics. And by that specifically, I mean the time parameter. I'm not giving it the same interpretation as the one in Willard's elite equation where time is born out of the equation. So it's quantum mechanics on the string theory landscape.
Excuse me, before you go on, what is the merit or the selection pressure or the fitness landscapes that selects the, is it just size?
No, it's dynamics. So following the dynamics of all the initial domains on that.
Yeah, so then we follow them and how does it tell us which one we're in?
Because each one of them will have matter and vacuum energy. So vacuum energy will try to make them grow, matter will try to make them collapse. Mm-hmm. If the surface gravity of this vacuum energy, which is like the Sitter surface gravity, it is stronger than the pool of matter. You can oversimplify and think of putting all the matter in a black hole. So you can talk in terms of surface gravities. So if the surface gravity of the Sitter part is stronger than that of the black hole made up from these massive modes, then that patch will grow. So the vacuum energy or gravitational degrees of freedom, if you like, will win over matter. And it's a totally far out of equilibrium that has to be studied with out of equilibrium dynamics.
So we're weighting the different patches by volume that they eventually get to?
No.
So what?
Quantum mechanics on a mini superspace, infinite dimensional mini superspace, where you have the scale factor as the degree of freedom, the landscape variable, and the infinite number of fluctuation modes. And it's a master equation from the Willard-DeWitt equation because you include the back reaction of the super horizon matter mode. So it's solutions to that master equation that there is nothing being put by hand in the sense of volume weighted or.
Okay, so we just evolve, and some of them turn out to be big, is that right?
Yeah, and some of them just disappear. They never grow.
Most of them disappear. Only one of them turns out to be big, maybe?
At the quantum level, maybe they're still around, but they never go big enough to go through the quantum to classical phase.
No, that's interesting.
Where does this universal time come from? I mean, the time in which you evolve, which you said doesn't come out of the...
Exactly. So I don't know the answer. I am taking the point of view that time is fundamental. So it's a quantum mechanical meaning of time. That's what I mean by doing quantum mechanics on the multiverse.
Where is the Hamiltonian going to come
from? Oh, it's a Willard-DeWitt equation plus the back reaction term of massive modes. So it will be the gravitational Hamiltonian, the Einstein-Hilbert part, plus the landscape part of string theory, plus the back reaction part. I skipped all those details because that was just an example.
What you're saying is d by dt, where t is this time that you produce, mm-hmm. is equal to h, the Willard-DeWitt operator, plus other stuff for the back reaction.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the difference is in the interpretational part. I mean, you start with the scale factor. That's one of your mini superspace variables. But I don't give it the meaning that Willard-DeWitt community. I'll not say that later time is born out of that scale factor. I'm thinking of time as a quantum mechanical parameter.
And do you do some kind of Euclidean rotation of the scale factor part so that it's an elliptic-y operator? Mm-hmm. The thing you call the Willard-DeWitt operator
Can I just ask you about the word meritocratic? So speaking up on Jim's question, so it's not democratic, it's not that all possibilities contribute equally. It's not reductionist, so there is one. But that some universes, so to speak, dominate, they have more merit.
Yeah.
But I was unsure about the criterion that gave them their dominance.
Dynamics that selected the survivor from the terminal universes, what I was describing before.
Some of them just sort of work better in some sense. The dynamics you're imposing means that some of them get promoted.
So in this picture, reductionism is sort of the ultimate meritocracy, right? One thing is picked. Whereas meritocracy, some things are picked. And in democracy, all things are picked. Is that, roughly speaking, the way you're thinking?
Not the first statement, because in both meritocratic and democracy, you have more than once. Selected by some criteria. Meritocratic is the dynamics that
say democracy, one person, one vote, so every universe counts. Meritocracy, one person, not one vote, some person's one vote. So that's what I understood Paul to be saying.
But
reductionism is only one person gets one vote.
Yeah.
Some call it dictatorship.
So there's...
So is reductionism dictatorship in this...
Well, that's awesome. Until a few years ago, we all hope there will be one solution coming from the theory. You're making me think maybe we have a mean streak in us.
There can be other definitions of reductionism. I'll try a different one tomorrow.
Okay. So, I gave an example on how this method might work and the different points of view of thinking about the problem, meritocratic or reductionist. But all this talk and all these predictions and calculations we do in different theories, we still have not asked the most simple question of all. What's the multiverse? In what space and what time and what determines that? What are the features of some generic multiverse? Perhaps there will be more theories and more multiverse predictions in the future. So let me think of an actual generic multiverse, not specific to a particular theory. Then can we at least have some kind of argument where we can talk about features of that generic multiverse and the space-time of that multiverse? So I think that since our universe has to be part of that multiverse, whatever it is. It might not be the one from string theory or inflation or quantum mechanics, but whatever that multiverse will be, since our universe has to be part of it, then it is quite plausible that the multiverse will go through a quantum phase and a classical phase. I also believe that since there is only one physical reality, whatever multiverse predictions or toy models or whatever we can come up with and imagine, only one of them at the end of the day will have to correspond to physical reality. So there is a second hidden problem of the selection. Instead of selection of initial conditions, now it's selection of a multiverse. And since I'm thinking of the multiverse, that it's all there is, there can't be more than one. So let's have some consensus at least on the definitions. Let's agree what we mean by multiverse, multi-worlds, and universe. I will take a very conservative view of the universe. I'll think of it only as the domain of space-time in which points were causally connected in some time slice in the past. And I'll think of the multiverse as the ensemble of all possible universes predicted by the unknown underlying theory. So all there is, it's all enveloped, it goes under the name multiverse.
With all possible initial conditions.
Sorry?
With all possible initial conditions.
Yes. And then you have the quantum phase and the classical phase. So it can shrink during the quantum to classical transition, but there is only one ending. All there is.
But you agree that, what I said this morning, that there will be a meta theory, so to speak, that will define the class of multiverse you're dealing with, because you might choose a multiverse, say, from a landscape, and then you might choose a different theory that have a different landscape. And these will be different multiverses.
Agree up to some level. I have a slightly different view, and I'll talk about the hierarchy. So that's where the meta theory and the meta multiverse.
But ultimately, to pick up on that, this is sort of reductionism bumped up one level, right? You now want to single out a unique multiverse from the possible multiverse class.
Yeah, the transition in Eastern Europe. Yeah.
So, but now, of course, the trouble is we can't observe any of that other stuff except the part in our local region.
I didn't make such statement. In fact, I don't believe it.
But I'm saying, in some sense, it still is sitting on a foundation of reductionism, to use your language. If I understand
why?
It. it's still sitting on a foundation of reductionism. I want to reduce to the unique multiverse theory by whatever mechanism.
So yeah, the multiverse itself, by definition, is reductionist. If you say all the multiverse includes all there is. Yeah.
Well, unless you get rid of the line between regions A and B and say that all that is everything. Everything that can exist does exist.
No. That's very different.
So you're looking for a rule that singles out multiverse.
Mark Stegmark says that. No, I don't say that. No.
You're also saying that only quantum theory and classical sets of rules are allowed. There's no other possibility?
No, I know that at least these two... I'm advocating that at least these two have to be there, these spaces, because our universe is part of the multiverse.
You could try other kinds.
Yeah. Something else on top of those is totally possible, but at least those two. If my universe is part of that multiverse and our domain went through these phases, then it makes sense that the whole multiverse went through similar phases.
And you've got relativistic causality, something like that as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hidden assumptions. Well, some not hidden.
But just to come back to your equation, right, if you haven't yet seen it, but I psi e t equals the wheeler to weather operator on psi. I mean, you need an initial condition for that equation in order to start the evolution, or is it believed that it's some sort of attractor?
No, I can show you that that's a talk I gave a year ago in New York, so it's not part of today's.
Unfortunately, I wasn't there.
But I'll show you all the equations. I've got them with me, fortunately.
Well, maybe we shouldn't interrupt. Maybe it's only me. My other question is, what happens to diffeomorphism in directions? Right, which is supposed to be the constraints acting on the wave function of zero, in which case you could know it.
Let's talk about it
privately, I suggest, right, because nobody else.
I have to show you the equation. So the initial conditions are the vacuum energies of the mini superspace landscape where these wave packets are seated. And some very strange things happen there, like Anderson localization, because, I mean, thinking of it as a family to the neighbor is not the right way to do the landscape business. It's an n-body problem. Totally non-perturbative n-body, and Anderson localization occurs there. So it's... But I can show you the big ones later.
Are you going to say that your new gravitational theory breaks diffeomorphism? Okay, thanks.
But I'll show you, I've got them in another talk, so I can show you these. Right, so back to the generic multiverses. What kind of types and hierarchy we can think of? The things I could think of varying were the laws, the constants of nature, and dimensionality. By no means is this list exhaustive. But let's at least use this as a frame for the discussion. We can envision a universe where different domains and different universes have different laws. Or where the laws are the same, which would be type B, but different constants of nature, different values for the constants of nature. Even worse, one where even the dimensionality of different domains is different, and each of those d-dimensional subdomains of the multiverse can subdivide into the type A and the type B with different laws and different constants of nature. So it can get a mess. Is there any way, and that's with current and limited knowledge of the multiverse, is there any way that we can create a hierarchy? Well, Stegmark in a seminal paper created that. He took... There are certain things on the Platonic interpretation I'm not sure I agree with, but I'll start with his level 4, which is type C in this division of the multiverses, where anything with different domains, different dimensions, different laws, and different constants of nature, that will be the big embedding multiverse, which can subdivide into the classes AD and BD. Now, our 3+1 dimensional multiverse, the domain of that big type C universe, will have a larger set where laws can vary across, and a subset of type A where laws are the same in this subdomain, but the constants of nature might be different. So that's one way to think of the hierarchy. And again, we can't avoid this issue of the interpretation. All of this probably comes out of mathematics, mathematical solutions of quantum equations or string theory equations or whatever. Now, the big question is the multiverse a mathematical or a physical entity? How far can we push our luck with mathematical entities in terms of their physical existence? I like Marx's point of view that any possible mathematical solution that comes out of your equations, if you don't have a good reason to throw it away, then you should take it seriously. So I would embrace that part. So that's the democracy part, Rob. But I would like to add a new ingredient to that interpretation and that understanding, which is the dynamics. That out of all these mathematical solutions, we should somehow inject the dynamics, which means we need to talk about space and time. And then, by investigating the dynamics, that will determine which part of the initial mathematical entity will survive and become a physical entity. So that's a new twist to the old Platonic view. Yeah.
I don't quite understand what that means. Does that mean you only include things, you only can include mathematical structures that can be mapped onto something that we would call time evolution of a system?
True.
Yeah, and exactly. Only one time, only one
no,
time.
No, direction. We didn't say one. That's next.
Okay, so, all right.
But if there is no time parameter?
So no time is ruled out.
Yeah.
And
but if there is not
time is not necessarily.
Yeah, it can be emergent, it can be fundamental, I'll discuss that next. But if there is no time and you can't talk of evolution, then it will be very hard to envision that mathematical entity be part of physical reality. I can't anyway. Okay, so a dynamical description demands space and time. In what space and in what time does the multiverse exist? And everything here is suggestions and question marks. I have no idea, of course, how the space-time is determined, but I would like to throw to the table two postulates. Let us determine space, the embedding space of the multiverse, by the principle of domains correlation. If domains are correlated in a multiverse, then they must belong to the same background space. That's the proposal. If there is absolutely no correlation between domains, then there is no reason why they cannot have their own spacetimes. So I will make the distinction here based on this principle of connected multiverses and disconnected multiverses. Let me also propose how do we determine time. And let me propose the use of time translation symmetry as the criteria for making sense and talking about time in the multiverse. So I will assume that quantum mechanics is valid and universal, and that there is a time-energy relation as a result. So if time translation symmetry is a symmetry of the multiverse, it means energy cannot be created or destroyed anywhere across any the domains of the multiverse. It can be transferred, of course, but not created and destroyed. So let me suggest that we use the principle of no perpetual motion to determine the time parameter in the multiverse.
You mean that there's a preferred time, a preferred Hamiltonian, and you know, diffeo symmetry is broken? And
I didn't mention the
No, if you have a preferred time, then you have a preferred time.
No, I don't. Okay. That's how I'm determining. That's why I need this postulate to determine time.
So I don't. Okay.
So if quantum mechanics is your theory, then you have a time-energy relation, say it's Schrödinger equation. If time translation is a symmetry, then you know what your time parameter is.
Yeah. When if you're in are you in quantum gravity? Then in quantum gravity, how do you?
So the only and very big assumption is that quantum mechanics is universally true at all realms.
So just to understand, so if I had some multiverse, I got a Hubble bubble here and another one over there, you're not going to allow a theory in which a hunk of energy here will disappear in this bubble and reappear there by some quantum or whatever process. Even though overall there'd be energy conservation, people living here will see energy destroyed, people living here will see it created.
As long
you're not allowing it.
No, I am allowing that.
You are allowing.
Yeah, as long, so I'm talking of a time parameter for the multiverse now. As long as in the multiverse, in the global picture, energy has not been created or destroyed. You can transfer from here to here, but you are not in totality creating or destroying.
But transfer is different in that these people aren't seeing the flow of energy through the boundary of the region, rather they see it sort of disappear or reappear, as the case
may be. Yeah, so that would be the difference between...
That's okay if you...
Yeah, the difference between local observers and global observers.
Laura, are you making it very complicated? I mean, is what you're saying that the framework in which you're going to describe your fundamental theory is a Hilbert space in which there's a Hamiltonian period?
Yeah.
That's all you're saying?
Yeah.
And the rest of it is just gossip.
Just
words that may or may not be applicable. So your fundamental theory has a Hilbert space, and your fundamental dynamics uses a Hamiltonian period.
Right. Yeah, and the rest of it...
The rest of it, don't bother to say because you're just going to get people confused.
It's principles on the table that you can take for me.
Yeah, and the observables in this theory are going to be self-adjoint operators in your Hilbert space.
Yeah.
Okay, and from that, there may be some approximate descriptions which are fields on manifolds, et cetera, but they're not going to be fundamental. Mm-hmm. Okay, so next slide.
Can I ask?
Yeah,
question about the first square, as opposed to the second, that one. Yeah, so it seems to me if you have a multiverse in which no correlations exist for all time, then what you've really got is two different theories.
Absolutely agree. Yeah.
Two different systems. You can talk about one, forget about the other.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. In fact, that's where I'm leading, that if nature is economic and there is no way for us to ever know about the existence of the other one, maybe that's one way to select which multiverse makes sense as a candidate for physical reality. Yeah.
Another question for the second one. Suppose if you're talking about some universes where there's inflation in a band, mm-hmm. and so if you look at two different ones, that occurs in two different times in general, and you can't connect those times since there wasn't any direct time to make a connection. So I don't know what you mean by there's only one time parameter if you have a bunch of different ones inflating and having big bangs.
So, yeah, in general, well, in the very general case, there is no need for a time parameter at all. In fact, type C, the one where even domains have different dimensionalities, could be such a case. But assuming that you are insisting, we take as seriously only the ones where you can define a time parameter. Then, if time is emergent, that scenario is totally plausible. That different bubbles will have their own different time parameters determined in terms of their own Hamiltonians. Yeah. Even those are quite hard to study and follow, so eventually perhaps, I mean, the point that I would argue is that although having emergent time is plausible, perhaps time, which nobody knows, will turn out to be fundamental at the end of the day. I don't know the answer of that, but that's probably...
You're allowing those kinds of things to happen.
I am allowing them, but then favoring, in my way of thinking, the type of multiverse where time is fundamental, where there is the same time parameter for all domains. Okay, so here comes to Tom's question. That if quantum mechanics survives, which is what Lee was saying, and if nature happened to be economic, then these two postulates would be enough to at least reduce the class of initial multiverses that might be candidates for physical reality to only the connected one. Since with the disconnected one, we'll never know, we are forbidden to even contemplate any way of knowing of their existence. So in that case, it makes sense that only the connected multiverse is part of our physical reality. I can't convince myself, never mind you, on favoring the case where time is fundamental, but it is
possible, I mean, I have my own reasons for this, it is possible that this connected multiverse might also be the one where time appears as fundamental. And I can give a very hand-wavy argument, which is not convincing at all. But imagine in the connected multiverses, you have either type A or type B. Type A is the one where the different where laws of physics vary across the domains. Type B is the one where laws don't vary, but the constants of nature vary. If laws don't vary, then there will be the same time-energy relation in all the domains. In that case, it is plausible to think that time can be a fundamental parameter rather than an emergent parameter. In the type A class, time definitely has to be an emergent parameter, because even the laws vary.
Oh, excuse me, isn't that the reverse? If the laws vary, then there must be some meaning to saying that the laws vary, which means there must be a global time, which is prior to the time parameter in the laws.
Well, imagine that the specific law that is varying is the time-energy relation.
What other meaning do you have to the laws there? You mean there's an ensemble of laws? Sure. But that's not varying implies something dynamical.
I mean varying across the multiverse.
Across an ensemble.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. So varying does not mean one law holds and then there's a transition and then another law.
No. So assume that you have the ensemble where the laws are different in the different members of the ensemble. Now,
so
that specifically.
What's the difference between that statement and just saying that there's an ensemble?
Because I'm calling the ensemble a multiverse. So talking about laws varying across the multiverse is the same as laws varying among different members of the ensemble that comprise the multiverse. But if the time-energy relation holds, and we have the same Schrödinger equation, for example, across all domains, among all the members of this ensemble.
That implies the global time.
Yeah, exactly.
Which implies the time, at least that global time may be called emergent, you know, within a sector of filtered space described by one of those laws. But if you have a d by dt, a global d by dt, then by definition is a global time.
Yeah.
And therefore,
which is in this diagram. So you can start. We are somewhere here. To us, time appears fundamental up to here, because we have this global concept of time, but here it wasn't.
And what I'm confused about is you said two slides ago that your setup is that there's a Hilbert space and there's a Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So there is a global time, period. Either that or there is no Hamiltonian in the Hilbert space. You can't have it both ways. If your fundamental principles are there's a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian, then there is a global time, and then you live with the consequences of that global time. If you don't believe there's a global time, then you don't get a Hamiltonian in your fundamental Hilbert space.
I was treating the most general case, the type C multiverse, where dimensionality changes, laws change, and everything.
And is there
that specializes.
No?
Sorry?
Is there a Hamiltonian there or no?
No.
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 Okay, so you can't now make a dynamical argument.
Yeah, and then specializing, going into the subsets where there is a Hamiltonian and you have the same dimensionality and you can talk about time energy relations and you have the same laws across.
Okay. But I don't understand. So now I don't understand why your principle of disconnection or whatever is inconsistent with the existence of a Hamiltonian. And certainly, I can certainly have a Hilbert, make a system which is a direct product of Hilbert spaces,
mm-hmm.
and invent a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of factors in those Hilbert spaces. There are no dynamically generated correlations between those sectors of Hilbert spaces. Nonetheless, there is a global Hamiltonian.
Because of the reason you just mentioned, the time. The moment you have the Hamiltonian, you already have picked a global time.
Yeah, but you say you like that.
No, I said that I started from the most generic case, where anything bad that can possibly happen does happen. And then specialized to the subdomains where quantum mechanics and the Hamiltonian and the time-energy relation holds. Eventually graduating to a really small subset. So you have a hierarchy.
At what point do you state the dynamics of your theory? And it's a constrained formalism or it's a Hamiltonian?
Hamiltonian. But and even that is hand wavy. I mean that's a proposal to use this formalism.
Okay, anyway, I feel like we're going around the circle.
So I like to suggest that even in terms of the word we use for the multiverse, if we are at a disconnected type where different domains, there are no correlations among domains, so they can have their own space-time background, and there is no way for us to tell from one domain whether the other ones exist. So I would suggest that we call that the multi-world rather than the multiverse. And then all the subdomains of this big embedding, very generic type, all the subdomains that are connected, like these circles, then we use the word multiverse only for the connected type, where at least we can talk about space and time and things like that. In order to determine which one of those types of mathematical multiverses are candidates for corresponding to reality, the new ingredient that I'm proposing is that we inject dynamics into this system, and then the ones that have a dynamical description from all the possible mathematical entities actually become physical entities. Suppose we have the connected multiverse is type A. It happened to be the subdomain that has 3+1 dimensions, so it's our type of multiverse. And suppose I've picked time to be fundamental. Then a subdomain, there is a nesting, a subdomain of this type A multiverse, which is connected, but which does have different laws on different domains. A subset will be the type B multiverse. There will be a small corner here where the laws do not vary, which has still more than one universe, but the laws in that neighborhood do not vary, and that's type B. Same laws, although the constants of nature can be different. Our universe will be somewhere part of this type B multiverse. So that's the kind of hierarchy I picture in terms of the multiverse and the connection of going from a Platonic view of promoting all mathematical entities to a candidate for physical reality, moving a step away from that view and introducing dynamics and the dynamical description, or at least being concerned about investigating this dynamical description of the multiverse in order to promote that object, that entity, to some physical reality. Now, is it crazy to contemplate observational imprint? I mean, at the end of the day, whatever we can think of and imagine for whatever good or bad arguments, unless we find some sort of observational handle to check our contemplations and principles, then it's not good enough. So I have no reason to argue against the possibility of having observational imprints. If that was the case, if there is no way we'll ever know of observational imprints, then we should forget about the multiverse and go home. But if multiverse is part of our physical reality, then there is absolutely no way why we cannot find these observational imprints, even in our very small domain, in our universe. And the reason is very simple. First, our universe, the big large universe today, is just a redshift of scales from the very small universe at birth, when our initial domain was entangled with everything else and mixed and everything. So those observational imprints should survive, and they should be imprinted in the large scale, low energy observables in the sky today. That's one reason. I mean, our universe is a perfect laboratory simply because of the redshifting of the scales. Another reason why I think it's not so crazy to contemplate observational imprints is the unitarity principle. If we believe that the unitarity principle is there, then once in a mixed state, you can never evolve into a pure state. So that kind of entanglement from the early times will survive to present day. It might be small, but it's there.
So we can hunt it down. And that will provide the imprints, the observational imprints, that there is something else out there, outside our domain, that there might be a multiverse. I went through this exercise on the string theory landscape, on the wave function of the universe on the landscape of string theory. And since I haven't shown you any details, that's a talk I've given many times in the past. I'll skip all there is, basically. But in that case, in that particular example, following this process of having the wave function propagate on the landscape superspace and finding out in what vacua does it localize and how many solutions do you get out of it, how they decohere from each other at late times, it is not difficult. I mean, that's a very, very well-defined recipe to calculate what are the observational imprints on present-day large-scale structure and CMB. And the way that calculation is done is you simply trace back the degree of mixing between our universe, due to this non-local entanglement, super-horizon non-local entanglement, and this mixing will influence, will modify the Newtonian background potential. You can trace that back or forward in time and find out how big that influence, that modification to the background Newtonian potential is. I'll skip that part. So that's how it's done. You have a decoherence width in the density matrix at the early times of existence of our universe. You know the entanglement contained through the width of the wave function squared. You can trace that back at late times. You know that the mixing will remain because of unitarity principle. Information can never be lost. And in that manner, just finding out how that mixing modifies the present Newtonian potential, the background Newtonian potential, you can make real observational predictions. In that particular example of the string theory landscape, and we use the model of Douglas and the Neff distribution of the landscape vacua, the predictions I made with my collaborators, Rich Holman and Tomo Takahashi, were that there must be a void, which was later observed, and the bounds on the SUSY breaking scale should be, if inflation occurred at gut scale, then the bounds on the SUSY breaking scale on our patch should be a few orders of magnitude higher than expected by particle physics. We also predicted that sigma A, the amplitude of the overall CMB spectrum, should be suppressed, should not be equal to 1. And indeed, a few months ago, WMAP, the measured value from WMAP is sigma 8 about 0.8. So far things look good. But again, I'm bringing this up only as an example on how contemplating observational imprints of the multiverse is not such a far-fetched hope. Yeah. That's exactly what I mean. So I mean, yeah, observational imprints at present, what I mean is there any way for me as a local observer in this particular domain to find out traces of this entanglement with all else outside just by looking at my observables? Yeah. Okay.
Same as the situation in which I'm just receiving a source of photons, each of which is in a pure state, from a situation in which I'm receiving photons which are entangled with other photons that are never measured. I think that that's correct.
That is correct, but part of the problem there is that decoherence is nowhere in the picture.
Whether there's decoherence or not, In other words, I can measure entanglement if I have reports of observations from both sides.
Yeah.
Okay, but I cannot detect by measuring one quantum system whether it's entangled with another quantum system that
correct.
I don't measure.
Unless decoherence occurred, in which case whatever entanglement there was, the moment this object becomes classical, it's implicit there for good.
But you wouldn't know, would you, just from a string of photons, whether decoherence had happened or not, or whether the entanglement remained.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell, because a photon doesn't come with a label. I am entangled with another photon 10 billion light years away.
True.
And it may or may not be. It may decohere. So there's no way you can locally determine
mm-hmm.
decoherence.
That's correct. So translating to the case for our universe, in the way you do it is if you have prior knowledge of the photon with and without the entanglement. In our universe, we don't have prior knowledge, but we do have prior favorite theories. We do a calculation of what the observable looks like if inflation is the only ingredient in the story of cosmology. And then you do a calculation if besides this channel of inflation that produces, that sees the large scale structure of the CMB, besides that, you have a second channel coming from this entanglement. And then you compare with what you observe in the sky. Now, I don't know inflation happens, so it's not the absolute accurate way to do physics, but if I believe inflation happened, this is what I should see.
But you're then postulating an observational handle on the other part of the entanglement. Right?
Yeah.
Then you're in with a chance because you're looking. You've got both.
Yeah.
But if you've only got one, I don't think you can tell anything.
So, if there is no multiverse, we just have the Big Bang inflation and we know how to calculate, we know the story, the primordial spectrum of inflaton fluctuations, see the cosmic microwave background, and it also see the large scale structure. We calculate them and we observe them. Now, I have a second channel, which is basically what I calculated here. This is the entanglement between, it's a highly non-local entanglement determined by this parameter V. And here it shows up as a modification to the Riemann equation. But anyway, so now I look at scenario number two, where there is this non-local superhorizon, non-local entanglement of my patch with all the other stuff. I have some underlying theory in which I can calculate this mixing. It's like the tail of the decohered wave function. And then I can bring it forward in time, redshift it forward in time, to find out what that entanglement looks like today, or that effect, bring it on from the moment of quantum to classical transition, what does it look like today?
Right, right.
So I can tell in that case, just by comparing with and without. The same story can be told on the other side.
At the same effort, can't you? So that your local observations and your cosmological observations
yeah.
are going to have a huge discrepancy in time. Because,
yeah.
So they could have decohered since.
Yeah.
So you're really just looking at evidence for the past.
Exactly. Which is, I mean, the calculating this stuff is just second order WKD approximation on the wave function. It's a very well defined recipe, mm-hmm. and there is no room for phenomenology there. It's a hard for calculation.
This is a calculation where you use semi classical gravity, where a classical Einstein equation is sourced by an expectation value of an initial momentum tensor.
Mm-hmm. That's just an example of the string landscape.
No. Yeah. I'm just trying to understand what happened in the calculation that you used to claim you made. So this is something like, you're telling me that if I look at the gravitational field,
mm-hmm.
okay, I can tell if my photon is entangled with another photon because the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor might point between them, and not just to the photon that I observe over here, something like that.
At the classical level.
Yeah, so you're using the fact that you're not doing linear evolution on a Hilbert space,
yeah.
but you're doing a coupled evolution which makes the evolution nonlinear and non-local.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to,
yeah.
One might argue that at this point, one might argue about whether that's a methodological issue, but at least that's how you use what you do.
Yeah, I wish we had full quantum gravity tools, but at the moment the only tools we have is semi-classical theory, and we've got to make progress with what we have. So this calculation, it's a master equation on the mini superspace of the landscape of string theory, with the distribution determined by Douglas and Donnet.
Okay.
And the master equation comes from this back reaction of super horizon modes, and that's where the super horizon entanglement comes about. The rest is just second order, semi-classical, second order WKB. One can calculate the corrections coming from the second channel, from the entanglement channel, to what would have been normal Newtonian background potential if inflation was the only thing that occurred. And this calculation, which is a classical one, can tell us whether there are any imprints at present time or not.
The trouble I have with this is, how do you know that extra term couldn't be explained by within our own horizon local physics?
That's an excellent idea.
Some kind of extraordinarily different thing that would look ultimate, contrived than anything anybody could think of. That was a within our horizon type theory, right?
No, you just have to find to look for a smoking gun on how you can distinguish your theory from the rest of all the frame models being cooked around. And it's an excellent question. In general, in whatever theory you come up with, if you see what you predicted in the sky, doesn't mean that you got proof for your theory. It's you still have to convince yourself that what your prediction is unique from any other prediction there is. And in this case, that there is a smoking gun. That's a different kind of work. It's more on the astrophysics side. How can you tell that what you're looking in the sky is your unique theory or not? One way to tell, to have a smoking gun on distinction, is by cross-correlating cosmic shear with cosmic microwave background. It's work I did years ago with Stina Mester. If inflation is your only story, then the primordial spectrum is the only seed you have to produce both for large scale structure, matter distribution, and the cosmic microwave background. So if you cross correlate, you can tell whether it's inflation or not, because they have the same primordial power spectrum. If you come up with a different theory that, besides inflation, put something else on the table, a second channel of contributions, by cross-correlating the cosmic shear that maps the large scale structure with CMB, you can immediately reveal the source. So that's a kind of unique signature that your model would give. In this case, I've shown what the CMB and the large scale structure would look like. And this morning, I cut out the smoking gun transparency, but I can show you in a minute. I have it in another talk. So I can show you what it looks like for this model. Okay, so I've been trying to throw some suggestions and more open the discussion on the foundations, very simple basic foundations of the multiverse and the ontology of the multiverse. Things such as what space, what time, what dimension, is there any way we can make sense of it? Are there any observational imprints that we can deduce about its existence? What hierarchy, what types, and which part of it corresponds to physical reality? So there are so many types already, there will probably be more being conceived in the future of multiverse candidates. And the two very simple principles that I wanted to suggest in order to determine the space and the time was no perpetual motion being allowed on the multiverse, so energy can be transferred between domains, but not created or destroyed in the total picture of the multiverse. And yes,
the same as no closed timeline correlates as well. You want to rule those out.
I haven't thought about that, but yes, you're right.
So universes that loop back on themselves.
Yeah.
Sort of cosmic perpetual motion.
Yeah.
Probably you don't want those.
Yeah, you're right, yeah. And the second one, determining the background space, was the proposal to use the correlation among domains. If domains in the multiverse are correlated with each other by any means, then it makes sense to think that they are all embedded in the same background space-time. If not, if we have totally disconnected domains, then there is no reason we'll ever know or care about that other disconnected part. So that's what I would use for making sense of background space-times for the multiverse. But I'm sure that many of these concepts and proposals and discussions will continue to be refined and refined until we have a deeper understanding. One thing that I think will stay with us for quite a while is that need to extend our physics to the multiverse framework. And that part I find fascinating. The rest is fun that we need to discuss and talk and determine what space and what time and all those what dimensions. So thank you.
Any questions? But there's time for a few more, perhaps.
I would like to understand better your argument about entanglement.
Say that again?
I would like to understand better your argument about entanglement. So let me try.
Entanglement?
Yeah, as an imprint of the existence of multiverses.
Okay, so the way you start from the birth of the universe, and you have this whole ensemble that you're talking. The multiverse on its quantum phase, or the phase space of the initial conditions. And then you study the decoherence issue. You calculate the density matrix, and the diagonal terms of the density matrix tell you how fast you decohere in both variables, in whatever scalar field you have, and on the scale factor, which is the gravity part. And there is a lift associated with it. Now, since you are doing quantum mechanics, unitarity is valid, the principle of unitarity. So what that means is that whatever little mixing you have at the beginning, that mixing cannot go away because information is not lost. That's the unitarity principle. You calculate the width of that density matrix, and you see that will tell you what the entanglement is, the non-local entanglement. And you bring it forward in time to find out how that information is transferred to the present day observables.
It's telling you the degree of mixing.
Yeah, exactly.
Not of entanglement.
Well,
you
say space is mixing, and space time is entanglement.
Entanglement with what?
Of our universe with all else outside,
so,
yes.
So, but what you see is a mixed state, right?
Yeah.
Then you have two possibilities. Whether it's a mixed state, or it's a mixed state because you traded out something else with which it was entangled, which is what you're saying, it's an imprint of something else. But this is always possible. For every mixed state, you can build an Hilbert space with other degrees of freedom such that the total state is a pure state. So there is no one, unless I'm...
No, I think...
Yes. No, this is the theory. For every mixed state on any Hilbert space, you can construct another Hilbert space and find...
Sorry, a what space?
Another Hilbert space with other degrees of freedom and construct a density matrix corresponding to a pure state such that the partial density matrix tracing out this new degrees of freedom is the state you started with. And this is a theorem.
Okay.
So so this tells you nothing because you can always do that. From observing just a mixed state, you cannot complain anything about anything else. You can always find a purification, as it's called, that does this job.
Well, I think I understand, but I don't really see the point. I mean, if I have a dynamical theory and I have an identification of some degrees of freedom I don't measure and some that I do measure within that dynamical theory, and the dynamical theory tells me how to construct the pure state, the pure entangled state, it gives me some particular density matrix. And it's true that I can't prove to you that the reason I have that density matrix is because of that particular dynamical entanglement, but that's the way we always do theoretical physics. You make up a story, and then you see whether the story predicts things that are correct or not. So it's always the case that any of our theories, you can invent an infinite number of other things that are that will reproduce the same data, but if you've done it and you've done it in a simple way, you say this is a success, and somebody else has to find an equally simple way of explaining the same data. Just because you could get a mixed saving in thousands of different ways doesn't mean that one particular way of doing it isn't the right description of the universe.
I agree with that.
So nothing can ever be.
It's not enough proven. To put that murderer in jail. You have to single out.
Right, kill.
It could be that.
Oh, Rob is gone. That's his correlation smoking on this.
You made a comment about supersymmetry breaking.
Yeah.
And I didn't get the sign of the comment. Is your claim that your theory predicts the Susie breaking scale is such that supersymmetric particles will not be found at the LHC or will be found at the LHC?
Yes.
Which will be found or will not?
Will not.
Will not be.
It's, so the bounds we, the way this comes about, in again, in the very specific landscape model, if Susi breaking is part of our theories, the initial vacuum energy on the landscape where our universe is localized, that vacuum energy is given by the Susi breaking scale. So it's a parameter, it's a local parameter that enters from the very start in the Lagrangian. That's why it shows up everywhere. It shows up today in the all the calculations, in fact. I'll, B, that's the Susi breaking scale.
Okay.
And we always know, if we have a parameter in the Lagrangian, it will show up in all the calculations for the observables. So that's how it shows up in the observables calculation, CMB or their scale structure. Now, the way we constrained that was to use the fact that the scale of inhomogeneities, even up to 100 times the Hubble size, the Hubble radius, should be less than 10 to the minus 4. So that kind of constraint immediately puts a constraint here on this term, saying this cannot be too big, which can be translated into a bound for B, for the Susi breaking scale. That was one of the constraints. The other constraint, so this is the constraint that the dipole moment and beyond should be less than 10 to the minus 4. The other constraint is that this term, which was much larger at the very earliest moments, it better not destroy the success of inflation, the slow roll condition of inflation. So these two translate immediately on bounds for the Susi breaking scale, but it is bound. The numbers you see here are only if inflation occurred at that scale, because in fact the bounds is a ratio of two scales, of V, the energy of inflaton, and B. So the actual bound will be, if inflation happened at God scale, this is it. If it happened at Planck scale, it will be B over V always that has to satisfy an upper and a lower bound. But if it started at God scale, then these are a few orders of magnitude higher than what we expect. Yeah, that's when I was looking at Nima's work only on the hierarchy of split hierarchies. Yeah. Well, we'll know in a week. October? Oh. Okay.
Ha 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 ha